Okay, I think we'll just get started, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the latest in the third series of Glasgow Centre for Population Health seminars, and I'm very pleased tonight to introduce Professor Bruce McEwen from Rockefeller University in New York. Every researcher will have the experience of wrestling with a problem and then suddenly encountering a reference or a bunch of references that seems to make the problem clear. You know, that feeling of the hair standing up in the back of your neck as suddenly you find someone that's done something that really is significant. And I had that experience a few years ago when I came across publications that Bruce had done around central nervous system development and the link between social conditions and physical conditions. So it's a really great pleasure to have him here in Scotland. Bruce started out by graduating in chemistry in the United States and went to work initially in psychology and then went to work in Sweden in neurobiology. He's been at Rockefeller University since 1981. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a fellow of the New York Academy of Sciences. He's a very distinguished guest that we've got here. He's a member of the MacArthur Foundation Research Network on Socioeconomic Status and Health. And having heard what this network is doing, it seems to me to have a lot of relevance to Scotland and Glasgow in particular in terms of translating evidence into policy. So it's a really great pleasure to have him here tonight to talk about molecules in mind, stress, the individual and the social environment. Bruce.
Thank you very much, Harry, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I've had an opportunity to discover a little bit about my McEwen ancestor, who was a Covenanter and was deported to New Jersey in about 1685. So it's been fun to sort of reconnect with that history and visit Bothwell Bridge today. I'm a neuroscientist and an endocrinologist, and as Harry indicated, I'm also part of the MacArthur Foundation Network for Socioeconomic Status and Health. And this becoming part of this network as a neuroscientist about 10 years ago, perhaps we could turn the lights down a little bit. Do I have the ability to do that? Okay, touch the screen.
Good. Lights.
We don't have to have them all off, but nope. I think it'll be easier. Thank you. Was a really a life-changing experience in the sense that it broadened me out from work in the laboratory, which I still do, to a broader perspective about the impact of experiences that we have, adverse experiences, especially on brain function and on health. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. You'll notice among the names here, Sir Michael Marmot, who founded the Whitehall study, which really presented to the world the notion that income and education, referred to as socioeconomic status or SES, is related in a very linear fashion to people's morbidity and mortality. From Whitehall 1, both men and women, according to the occupational status of their husbands, more recently according to their own occupational status, show linear gradients of life expectancy that are in which obviously the people at the highest levels have the best chances of living a long time. The same thing is true for morbidity to a number of diseases. And this is, of course, a fascinating puzzle. And so as part of our MacArthur Foundation network, and of course here in Glasgow and many other places, those of us who are interested in this topic are asking the question, how does SES get under the skin? And so that's the topic of this evening's talk. Not only is it true for physical health, but also in as much as it's been studied for mental health, affective disorders, anxiety disorders, and substance use are all show gradients according to income and education. Not surprisingly, gradients according to income show the greatest problems at the lowest income levels, perhaps because of the fact that people with these problems are not able to get or maintain jobs. But it's more perhaps interesting and meaningful to see the gradients that you can see with education. So, and we know now that many of these so-called psychiatric disorders are accompanied by also disorders in physical health. And we'll get more into that as the talk goes on. So I'm going to, a series of questions and attempts to provide you answers and start you thinking about some of these areas. Admittedly, I'm going to cover a lot. My students and colleagues refer to talks like this as Big Mac attacks, and so you're about to get a Big Mac attack. So the first question, how do brain and body communicate? Well, in the title I used the word mind, which the Oxford English Dictionary defines as the seat of thought, of awareness, thought, volition, and feeling. William James said that feelings and emotions were in part due to the perceptions of autonomic and visceral reactions, the tightening of the stomach, the palpation of the heart. And clearly, our experiences reflect our physical and social environment, including times when we have a stomach ache or feel pain or have a cold or the flu. And in fact, what we refer to as mind really reflects the whole body, and that reflects a two-way communication using nerves and immune and the neuroendocrine system, which are depicted here. The autonomic nervous system has two parts, the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches. The neuroendocrine system involves the hypothalamic brain regulation of all major hormone systems of the body. And the immune system is a dispersed system throughout the body which is innervated and responds to virtually every hormone in the body. When we think of stress, we think, I think, most commonly of things like adrenaline and cortisol. But in reality, the network that is activated when we are under stress is much broader than that. And this is even a small subset of all the mediators, but at least it includes not only sympathetic but parasympathetic influence, the so-called inflammatory and pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines, and inevitably linked to this inflammatory process are the generation of reactive oxygen species and so-called oxidative stress. The point is that although we tend to measure only perhaps one or several things at a time, like our heart rate or blood pressure or our cortisol levels, in fact, all the time when we are stressed, all of these mediators are being activated and they're regulating each other. So we're talking about a network, a non-linear network, rather than a simple linear chain. And we have to keep that in mind, even though we are not able to measure the whole system at once. In 1988, Peter Sterling and Joseph Iyer at the University of Pennsylvania introduced a term, allostasis, which literally means to maintain stability by being different or by changing. And they were referring to blood pressure, which of course increases when we wake up in the morning, get out of bed, increases when we walk up a flight of stairs or are emotionally aroused. And it helps us to adapt to situations, it helps us to survive situations, but at the same time, if our blood pressure doesn't come down, it stays elevated, then adverse consequences result. And so with the late Elliot Steller, we broadened the concept to include all of the mediators involved in stress or all mediators of allostasis. And we coined the term allostatic load, which refers to the fact that although the system may maintain or achieve stability or homeostasis under stressful circumstances, the repetition of these stressors and their dysregulation, the dysregulation of this network of allostasis, can result in a wear and tear on the body and brain, which over time can lead to diseases and various disorders. So the next question then, so what do we mean by stress? Stress is a word that occurs in many languages. It's a term that many of us use regularly to refer to things in our daily lives. But it's also an ambiguous term. If we're thinking about a zebra being chased by a lion, this cover of this wonderful book by Robert Sapolsky, it's the fight or flight response, the acute response that gets the prey out of danger, perhaps, and after that, then there's the process of replenishing depleted energy stores and repairing wounds and the like. But at the same time, perhaps the zebra is not worried and goes back to its grazing and so forth until the next encounter. Human beings have the problem that we worry. We have anxieties. And as a result of those anxieties and other things in our lives, we often engage in health risky behaviors. And the experiences that we're talking about here are perhaps better described under the term being stressed out. And so we'll come back to this a little bit later. Now, the important thing to remember about the mediators of allostasis are that they have acute adaptive effects, but produced chronically. And when dysregulated, they can also cause problems. And we can see this with cortisol. First, on the left, is the summary of the idea of the stress cascade, the notion that experiences, neural inputs, culminate, focus on the hypothalamus and cause the secretion of two chemicals, CRH and vasopressin, which go to the pituitary gland and cause it to release ACTH, which travels to the adrenal cortex and causes it to produce cortisol. Meanwhile, there are neural impulses that more rapidly have reached the adrenal medulla and have triggered the production of epinephrine or adrenaline. Now, acutely, cortisol and also adrenaline have the ability to enhance immune function. I'll say more about that in a minute. They enhance certain aspects of memory, like memories that'll keep us out of trouble the next time danger occurs, or specific events of something that might be helpful. They are involved in energy replenishment and making cardiovascular function more efficient. But chronically, we know very well that they suppress inflammation, they suppress immune function. As I'll tell you, they also impair aspects of brain function, including memory, and produced chronically, as in Cushing's disease or melancholic depression, they can promote bone mineral loss, muscle wasting, and they contribute to the metabolic syndrome. And this is often described as an inverted U. And to a great extent, this is true of all of the mediators of allostasis. In small amounts, properly regulated, they promote adaptation, and yet dysregulated, they contribute to these diseases. An example of immune function work of a former student, Firdaus Dabar, for his PhD thesis. If you immunize a rat or a mouse, and then several weeks later expose the ear to the chemical antigen, the ear swells, and you can measure the swelling with a pair of calipers. And it's not just because water is coming in, it's because immune cells are moving in from the blood to fight the pathogen, if that was what it was, or even to repair a wound. This is the basal response. It's called a delayed type hypersensitivity response. If you stress the animal by restraining it at this point before applying the antigen, the ear thickness is enhanced. And if you do a more severe stress of immobilizing the animal and also shaking it, the response is even greater. And you see it lasts for as much as 6 days. Now that's acute stress. If you do repeated stress for 21 days, restraining the animal, the 2 hours of restraint, at the end of the 21 days, the DTH response by the antigen is now markedly suppressed. So somewhere in between the single stress and the 21 days of repeated stress, you achieve a reversal and a profound suppression in which immune cells now do not traffic as readily to the ear. The same repeated stress scheme I'll describe later and show you some of its effects on brain cells. Okay, being stressed out. When we are feeling overwhelmed, out of control, exhausted, anxious, frustrated, and angry, what happens to us? We lose sleep at night. We eat too many of the wrong things, drink too much alcohol or smoke if we're so inclined, and because we're focused perhaps on solving problems, writing that grant, doing something that keeps us in front of the computer and otherwise away from doing things out of doors, we neglect regular moderate exercise. All of these contribute to allostatic load because they help to dysregulate these mediators of allostasis. An example of what happens with sleep deprivation, even getting, say, 4 or 5 hours of sleep several days in a row, we have increased blood pressure, decreased parasympathetic tone, elevated evening cortisol, glucose, and insulin, elevated levels of inflammatory cytokines, increased appetite due to in part to the production from the gut of ghrelin, which is a hormone that actually has effects on the brain as well. And these can increase then when we eat more. Caloric load helps to increase the first three of these. There may be depressed mood and impaired cognitive function from sleep deprivation. We all, I think, know this from our own personal experience. If this goes on for long periods of time, it accelerates allostatic load. And there are many people in our society who, for a variety of reasons, because of work or because of anxieties and so on, suffer from inadequate amounts of sleep. One of the recently reported consequences of chronic stress mediated by oxidative stress is the shortening of telomeres and the inhibition of telomerase. Now, telomeres are the ends of chromosomes. They're DNA pieces that each time a cell divides, they get shorter. And the measurements are made, in this case, on samples of white blood cells, which have the capacity to divide the immune cells when an immune response occurs. And in this particular study, the caregivers of autistic children were studied, and as a function of whether they perceived this experience to be stressful, perhaps because of lack of adequate social support and so on, because of the severity of the autism, and also as a function of length of time being a caregiver, there was up to one decade of accelerated aging, shortening of telomeres and inhibition of telomerase. Investigators have reported telomere shortening with aging, that's well known, and also with disorders like diabetes and cardiovascular disease and also depressive illness. So this is a new endpoint What's not clear is the degree to which the shortening of telomeres in white blood cells is responsible for example, impairing wound healing or impairing immune defense responses. That would be logical to assume. So we don't know the physiologic significance of this as yet. So this is a scheme where we think about not so much about the major events, but the stresses of daily life. Operating on a pre-existing state of brain and body, which we'll come back to later, resulting in varying degrees of chaos, conflict, lack of control, a very important aspect of all of our lives, feeling of control or lack of control, leading to anxiety, depression, and disturbed sleep, leading to behaviors like overeating, smoking, heavy drinking, or lack of physical activity, and then causing this increased physiologic stress burden we call allostatic load or overload, resulting in chronically elevated cortisol, insulin, inflammatory cytokines, conditions like tachycardia, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and then over time exacerbating diseases, the so-called diseases of modern life, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, coronary artery disease, arthritis, depression, and chronic fatigue are all different manifestations of this. There's a good side. Andrew Steptoe, who spoke here in another lecture in this series, and his colleagues, Jane Wardlaw and Michael Marmot, have examined people in terms of their positive or negative attitude towards their lives, and independently of daily hassles, they published this paper that showed that people who have a positive, generally positive affect have lower levels of cortisol, a lower resting heart rate, and less, they generate less fibrinogen, which is one of the acute phase response factors, in response to an applied experimental stressor. And of course, there's increasing interest in the phenomenon of so-called positive health and whether it is simply more than the absence of allostatic load, whether there are chemicals that are particularly related to that aspect. Okay, how does stress affect the brain? That's where our laboratory, most of our laboratory studies are going, and we do collaborate with investigators who do structural and functional imaging of the brain. The big picture, again, is the notion that the brain, of course, is the organ that perceives and decides if something is threatening, is stressful. It regulates the behavioral responses we've talked about, the physiologic responses that lead to adaptation, and that also can produce allostatic load. We know that perceptions of stress are highly individualized. They depend on differences in our genetic constitution, our early developmental history, and the experiences we have in adult life. And I'll talk a little bit about the first two as we go on. But again, just to remind you that besides trauma and abuse and the major life events, the daily hassles of daily life, of course, are also perhaps more very important in determining ultimate allostatic load. The brain, the three areas that we're particularly interested in include the hippocampus, which is involved in contextual, episodic, and spatial memory, the amygdala, which is the seat of emotions and fear, anxiety, and aggressiveness, and the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in executive function, decision-making, working memory, and a number of other things I'll mention later. And in disorders like major depressive illness, there are reports that with prolonged depression, there is shrinkage of the hippocampus, also some shrinkage of the prefrontal cortex, and ultimately shrinkage of the amygdala. But in the initial phases of depression, there are some reports that there may be hypertrophy of the amygdala. In any case, mood and anxiety disorders are accompanied by amygdala hyperactivity, and I'll say more about this as we go forward. In laboratory studies of stress, we use a restraint stress, the one that we use to study the immune system, a more severe immobilization stress, which is commonly used in laboratories to enable investigators to sample blood from the tail using both restraint or immobilization. These are commercially sold cones. And then in a more naturalistic setting, the tree shrew, which is like a squirrel but is an insectivore, if you put an intruder into the cage next to a dominant animal that likes its own privacy, the intruder is subjected to harassment, and I'll say more about this a little bit later. In all of these conditions, if this goes on for a number of weeks, there are changes in behavior, impaired spatial learning, increased aggression, increased fear, behavioral depression and learned helplessness, and impairment in mental flexibility. And as I'll be telling you very shortly, there are changes in the structure and connectivity of nerve cells. There's reduced neurogenesis in the hippocampus, shortening of the dendrites, the processes of nerve cells in the hippocampus and in the prefrontal cortex, parts of the prefrontal cortex, but there's expansion of dendrites in another part of the prefrontal cortex called the orbital frontal cortex and in the basolateral amygdala, which is probably responsible for the increased aggression and increased fear. So it's not damage, it's a remodeling process that changes both the structure of the brain and the behavior that, and responses that the animal generates. In the hippocampus, which we've studied most extensively, this is the circuitry of the hippocampus, it's cross-section through this brain structure. The input from the rest of the brain comes in here to the dentate gyrus and is relayed first via the mossy fiber pathway and then the Schaffer collateral system to this part of the hippocampus, and that's the output side. This is the particularly sensitive and vulnerable circuit. The cells of the dentate gyrus are replaced slowly, not all of them, but some of them are replaced during adult life. And these cells are particularly vulnerable to seizures for a variety of anatomical and physiologic reasons. They are the first to die when there is are seizures. And it's perhaps then makes sense that with repeated stress, which activates this system, these dendrites shrink, and the connectivity is reduced. And this may actually be Mother Nature's attempt to reduce the damage that might result. So this is one of the things that we study in the laboratory. This is what these cells look like. The CA3 neurons, their apical dendrites, are these wonderful tree-like branches. They have basal dendrites. This is the cell body where the cell nucleus is. And with repeated stress, there isn't any major change in the basal dendrites, but the apical dendrites become shorter and less branched. But this is a reversible process. It's not permanent damage. In the dentate gyrus, which I showed you earlier, there's the replacement of nerve cells because there are progenitor cells that are derived from the so-called glial cells or support cells of the brain, and they slowly divide and replace neurons that are dying at a rate of about 9,000 per day, and each new neuron lasts for perhaps about 30 days, although its survival, the survival of these new neurons can be increased by voluntary exercise and by certain kinds of learning that require the function of the hippocampus. At the same time, stress suppresses neurogenesis, and interestingly enough, antidepressants, including exercise, increase neurogenesis, and this is thought to be one of the biological, perhaps biological, processes that mediates the effects of depression, antidepressants on depressive illness. the tree shrew I introduced to you before. If this intruder is experiencing stress for 28 days living next to the hostile dominant, the intruder shows a reduction in body weight compared to a cage control, an increase in cortisol in its urine, an increase in catecholamines, adrenaline in its urine, and sustained over this period of time. And they do show the debranching of dendrites and also the reduction in neurogenesis in the dentate gyrus. And they show, as a result of this stress, depressive-like symptoms that can be prevented along with these morphologic changes, also prevented by certain kinds of antidepressant drugs. This, I should add, is work of Eberhard Fuchs, who's at the German Primate Center in Göttingen. We've collaborated with him on some of this, but a lot of this is work that he's done quite independently. With prolonged depressive illness, the work of Yvette Chaline in St. Louis, there is a reduction in hippocampal volume. This is what a part of the hippocampus looks like when you image the brain from one angle. The other part, when you do a cross-section, the hippocampus is there. And you can measure it and estimate its volume. And the longer the depression goes on, 10 years or more, you begin to see reductions in hippocampal volume. The same thing is true for mild cognitive impairment in aging. This is a condition of memory loss that is not at the level of what occurs in dementia. MCI is accompanied by a reduced volume of the hippocampus. This is work from Moni de Leon's group in New York at NYU. Alzheimer's disease results in a much more severe disconnection and shrinkage of the hippocampus. MCI is interesting because it is a risk factor for dementia later on. And one of de Leon's colleagues, Antonio Condit, has shown that the severity of MCI is related to poor glucose tolerance, not at the level of type 2 diabetes. The worse the glucose tolerance, the smaller the hippocampus, and the worse the memory performance. And Condit now has a study showing that with frank type 2 diabetes, there is much more severe hippocampal shrinkage. Now, the hippocampus has glucose transporters, like the many of the peripheral organs, which are insulin sensitive. And insulin does get into the brain, this is something that's very important to keep in mind, because type 2 diabetes is a risk factor for Alzheimer's, just as MCI is. And so part of the whole unsuccessful aging process may very well be linked as much to impaired glucose utilization as also elevated cortisol. And indeed, cortisol is elevated in MCI. Now, I just wanted to point out very briefly that a number of hormones, insulin, IGF-1, and then the hormone that stimulates appetite, gut hormone, ghrelin, and also leptin, which is a fat hormone that's associated with appetite suppression, all of these get into the brain, get into the hippocampus, are actively transported in, and they have some very interesting effects. I mentioned the effects of insulin, glucose transport, but also neuroprotection. IGF-1 is the mediator of exercise-induced neurogenesis. It's actively taken up during voluntary exercise. Leptin has effects to enhance excitability and to improve memory and possibly to act as an antidepressant. But I just saw a paper recently that in anorexia nervosa, there is, in fact, elevated leptin, and this may possibly contribute to some of the symptoms of anorexia in terms of arousal and hyperexcitability. Ghrelin, although it stimulates ingestion of comfort foods and sleep deprivation, also gets into the brain and enhances memory and promotes the formation of new connections between hippocampal neurons. So it's not just cortisol, but other hormones that seem to have access to the brain and affect many of the same processes we're talking about. A very interesting sideline that goes back to a study of cortisol secretion. And this is a public speaking challenge, a study that was done in Germany and by Clemens Kirschbaum and Dirk Hellhammer at Trier, looking at people's cortisol response to standing up, as I'm doing now before an audience and giving a talk, only in this case, the person is asked to talk about some very personal experience and is obviously somewhat aroused and stressed by it. And most people, the first time they do this, they have elevated cortisol. And the second, third, fourth, or fifth time they do this, their cortisol response is minimal. But there was a subgroup of people that produced higher levels of cortisol, and every time they produced high levels, a cortisol response. And these people turn out to have low self-esteem. And, of course, the notion that the cortisol contributes, perhaps, to the shrinkage of the hippocampus in aging and in some of these other conditions, as well as perhaps the hippocampus, we know, controls the shutoff of cortisol, so it's kind of a vicious cycle, as this part of the slide says. Well, a man named Jens Prusner, who is at McGill, who went from the Trier group to McGill, has published a paper not so long ago showing that both a set of young subjects and a set of older subjects that have low self-esteem had, in fact, a smaller hippocampus. And so one of the intriguing new leads in this area is the linkage between this trait that individuals have. And, of course, the question is, if you improve somebody's self-esteem, could you actually make the hippocampus get larger? In Cushing's disease, we know there is a smaller hippocampus, and if you treat the Cushing's, there is some evidence that the hippocampus will get larger again. So again, this may not be permanent damage, but some kind of a remodeling process. Now, in both the prefrontal cortex and in the amygdala, there is remodeling of neurons. In the medial prefrontal cortex, it shrinks like the hippocampus. In the amygdala, it grows. I've already mentioned this, but just to remind you again, I've also said that in mood and anxiety disorders, the amygdala and also the prefrontal cortex are hyperactive. Even though prefrontal cortex is smaller, it's more active. Successful treatment with antidepressants reduces this activity, but in general, the amygdala hyperactivity remains even after successful treatment. But we know that the prefrontal cortex exerts downstream inhibitory effects. And it may be that that is what is keeping the amygdala somewhat in check and helping to maintain more or less normal mood and levels of anxiety. In fact, the medial prefrontal cortex communicates with the amygdala in a reciprocal way. And as I said earlier, studies of the medial prefrontal cortex, which we've done in collaboration with John Morrison's laboratory, he's at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, have shown the shrinkage of dendrites and also the reduction of the spines. These are sites of excitatory synaptic connection. So stress, repeated stress, results in debranching of dendrites and also a reduction in the input from other cells, with the result that there is impaired mental flexibility. And yet this is a reversible process. When you cease stress, this mental flexibility returns, and this has been very nicely demonstrated in a PhD thesis that's not yet published, so I'm only just going to describe it, but a study on medical students who are studying for their medical licensing exam. And the way that stress is assessed is using this 10-item perceived stress scale developed by Sheldon Cohen at Carnegie Mellon University. And if you notice some of the items on it, it asks questions that really have to do with whether you're stressed out or not. How often have you been upset because something happened that's unexpected? Or how often were you unable to control the important things in your life? How often have you felt nervous and stressed or stressed out? And on the other hand, it asks other kind of questions. How often have you felt confident about your ability to handle things? Or how often have you felt that things were going your way? And so on and so forth. You fill out this questionnaire, and it's scored in a way that reflects the degree of the negative side of things. And it turned out in this study on medical students that was done by Connor Liston that, in fact, the medical students who were the most stressed out were impaired on a test of mental flexibility that's very similar to what we used in rats. And he also developed some evidence using functional MRI imaging that supported deficits, reversible ones, in the circuitry that's very analogous to the circuitry in the rat brain. Giving these medical students, after their exam, a month off resulted in return to normal, both in the their perceived stress test and also in their performance and in the brain imaging. So again, reinforcing the idea that these effects of stress can be reversible. Now, one of the things that about the prefrontal cortex is that it is extraordinarily important not only for decision-making, executive function, for mental flexibility, for extinction of fear conditioning, which is learning of new things to tell us that, well, it wasn't so dangerous after all, working memory, ability to suppress negative thoughts, so it's implicated in mood disorders, and also dysfunction of the prefrontal cortex is implicated in as results in learned helpless behavior. But it's also important in downstream and regulation of the parasympathetic system, and if there's dysfunction in the medial prefrontal cortex, there's very poor parasympathetic control to counterbalance the sympathetic response. And the prefrontal cortex also participates along with the hippocampus in shutting off the cortisol response. Okay, say a little bit about early life experiences, because remember in that diagram of the brain as the center of our ability to handle stress, referred to both genetics and early life experience. In animal models, prenatally stressing a mother results in increased rates of brain aging and shorter lifespan because of, and it perhaps in part, because of an increased reactivity and increased levels of cortisol, and probably these other mediators have been talking about. If you separate pups from mothers for a brief period of time after birth and when you put them back with the mother licks and grooms them and provides exceptional maternal care, this can in fact wipe out the effects of prenatal stress and produces animals that have decreased rates of brain aging and a somewhat longer lifespan. And so this is the animal model that, going back to work of Seymour Levine, Victor Denenberg, Robert Ader, and more recently Michael Meany at McGill and Paul Plotsky at Emory University, very important work that gets us thinking about the human condition. Work by Gary Evans at Cornell, looking in rural poverty, looking at the home environment, both in terms of crowding and chaos within the family, have shown that a chaos in poverty, and I'm sure in other situations, leads to helplessness, leads to poor self-regulatory behaviors, and an increased level of psychological distress. We know from work of Kim Noble and colleagues at Penn in collaboration with people in New York that studies of inner city kids in New York and Philadelphia show, again, in relation to the kind of chaos and the setting that Gary Evans talks about, impaired language ability and also impaired executive function. And Evans and others have documented that in this poverty situation, the level of adversity is related to increases in blood pressure and body mass already at 9 years of age. In the studies of child abuse and neglect by Robert Anda and Vincent Felitti and colleagues, they have zeroed in on not only problems with mental health, impulsive behavior, substance abuse, and so on, but increased levels of ischemic heart disease, and they emphasize the importance of the behavioral factors as powerful risk factors for development later in life of ischemic heart disease. So then this comes back to this diagram you've seen before, in which we can add in then traumatic stress or chaos or neglect in helping to determine a pre-existing state of the brain and body that makes the effects of these daily life stresses and experience that people have even more powerful in terms of their effects on later disease. But let's not forget about genes. And I'm sure most of you are aware of the groundbreaking work of Avshalom Kaspi and his team, based upon studies in Dunedin in New Zealand, in which in several different papers in Science, they showed in one of them that normally present alleles of monoamine oxidase A, if you had a certain allele, it increased the likelihood that when a child is abused, that this child will then, as an adult with antisocial behavior and other things, transmit this trait onto his or her own child. And in another study looking at normally present alleles of the serotonin transporters, which are a big deal now in biological psychiatry, that if you had a certain allele, it increased the likelihood that stress in adult life would contribute to major depressive illness. You had to have the experience in order for this allele to make a difference. So it's a very nice illustration of the subtle balance between genes and environment, the nature-nurture interaction. And then finally, just a brief word about social hierarchies, because the implications, of course, of things like socioeconomic status brings to mind social hierarchies in animals. And indeed, studies that we've been part of using the visible burrow system, in which you put six males and two females together. The males establish a dominance hierarchy. The dominant male is the one with the fewest scars on his body because he's going around biting the other guys. You have an open burrow and several tunnels, and then some places, chambers, where these animals can hide, and all of this is videotaped from above. The subordinates have low levels of testosterone, high levels of stress hormones, and a lot of changes in brain chemistry that I don't have time to describe. And some subordinates are more stressed than others. In fact, some will die within the two-week framework in which this is carried out. And the dominant, interestingly enough, has smaller adrenals than the subordinates, but larger adrenals than if it was living in a standard cage environment. What's interesting about the hippocampus is that both the dominant and the subordinate show reductions in dendritic complexity in this area of the hippocampus I've already talked about. But if anything, the dominant has the smaller dendrites than the compared to the subordinate, even though it's the subordinate that has the larger adrenals. And what this told us is that it's not just cortisol. And we know now that excitatory amino acid transmitters and other endogenous factors in the brain help to determine the degree of shrinkage of the dendrites. We also know from studies done at Bowman Gray University on cardiovascular function that in an unstable dominance hierarchy, male cynomolgus monkeys show the dominant shows increased atherosclerotic plaque formation. In the stable dominance hierarchy, there isn't any difference. For females, this is for males. For females, subordinate social status, whether it's in a stable or unstable hierarchy, increases the rate of atherosclerosis. There's a lot of other evidence. I just mentioned these two in passing. So we come then back to the SES and health links. And, of course, recognize that it's an extraordinarily complicated process. I've emphasized things about lifestyle, stressors, the daily life events. We also have to recognize that perception of social position is a major factor. that perceived or actual discrimination is a factor, and that education resources, not only money and intellect, but also having the life skills to deal with one's daily life are also very important, as well as access and use of health care. So it's a monumental task to unpack this and understand it. So what can be done about it? Well, I'm just going to suggest some things or show some evidence of some things that are worth discussion. First, we have medicines, and we have medicines of various kinds, beta blockers, prazosin for PTSD, anxiolytics, antidepressants, glucocorticoid receptor and CRF antagonists that are experimental, anti-diabetic medications, I should have added statins, anti-craving drugs, the endocannabinoid antagonists, and anti-inflammatory medications. And all of these are extraordinarily useful, but they also will each of them have side effects of their own, and they're not available to everybody, particularly not in the United States, where we have big problems with the health insurance problem, many people uninsured. There's another side, which is equally important to medicines and works in the direction of prevention, and these are, not surprisingly, social support, physical activity, and programs that that combine both. And I'll just briefly mention from the MacArthur studies I've been part of, work that examines social support, whether people have three or more social ties or only a couple of them, makes a big difference for both men and women with their allostatic load score. The more social ties you have, the lower the score. Physical activity, and we're now not talking about becoming a marathon runner, but people who were sedentary, who were over a six-year period encouraged and able to do 30 minutes of walking a day, showed a almost 60% reduction in their incidence of type 2 diabetes. There was another group where activity was not controlled, but they were given metformin, which enhances insulin actions, and they were also helped. What we know from other studies in animals and people is that exercise improves aspects of cognitive function and also is an effective antidepressant if you can get people to do this. This is just showing some pictures of newly formed cells in the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus. We know that voluntary exercise mediated by IGF-1 uptake enhances neurogenesis. The brain chemicals called neurotrophins are increased by voluntary exercise, and exercise is an antidepressant treatment, and chemical antidepressants also increase neuronal proliferation. Studies on sedentary people encouraged to exercise, like in the diabetes prevention trial, for only a six-month period at the end of the time showed enhanced activation of brain areas that are involved in attention and executive function, showing that regular activity benefits the brain as well as the metabolic system. And then a program based in Baltimore, but increasingly used in other parts of the United States, called the Experience Corps, combines sort of both of these, physical activity, social connectedness. It's called the Experience Corps. It involves the training of elderly volunteers to become teacher's assistants in elementary schools. They receive some money, they training, and obviously the educational process of the kids works much better because the teacher has someone to help them and somebody with a grandmotherly or grandfatherly personality. But what's also documented here is that the health of the elderly volunteers improves because, as the slide says, they have increased physical activity, increased social interactions, and you can say they probably, many of them, found a meaning and purpose in life. This is a program that may well be adopted statewide in Maryland because the mayor of Baltimore, who has become a supporter of this, was just elected governor, and we'll see if this will spread and be a useful type of intervention. So, as I said, I've given you a Big Mac attack, covered a lot of territory. There's a huge number of people that I should acknowledge. I gave you a glimpse of the last slide. The question is, how do I manage my allostatic load? One of the ways is shown here. Having a dog who gives you perspective on life and sort of a total sense of the ridiculous sometimes is wonderful counterbalance for what we have to go through on a daily basis. And I'll leave this up for a little while. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much, Bruce. Like most Big Macs, that was very pleasurable and enjoyable.
As long as you don't eat too much of it, right?
A real tour de force that filled in for me a lot of stuff that I've not taken in reading many of these publications over the years. We've got time for some questions. Could those of you who are asking a question identify yourself and where you're from? Yes?
Absolutely. I'm a PhD student. So I'm working on the basis of leukemia, basically. And I have a quite interesting question, I think, because it's quite related to my field of interest. As you mentioned in one of your previous first slides, that it has been shown that telomere attrition is a feature of stressed organism. And you also shown that chronic stress actually contributes to the suppression of neurogenesis. Mm-hmm. And obviously impairs different aspects of neuronal networking. So I was wondering whether anybody has, and obviously as a consequence of telomere shortening, it's a senescence, which is a permanent growth or is accompanied by a set of alterations in the phenotype and metabolism. So I was wondering whether it has been investigated by anybody that this actual inhibition of neurogenesis is caused partially by senescent cells due to the telomere attrition.
Very good question. I mean, really, I think this is probably one of the next research questions, because now that we know how to identify the progenitor cells in the brain, one could begin to study their telomeres. We do know this, that if as a rat ages, its rate of neurogenesis declines. And there are actually two ways of re-stimulating it. One of them is to adrenalectomize it, removing the source of glucocorticoids, which rise on the average as a rat gets older. And we know that if you give glucocorticoids, you suppress neurogenesis. Another way is to block NMDA receptors, which we know normally inhibit neurogenesis. NMDA receptors are the receptors for the most prevalent transmitter in the brain, glutamate, and they're present everywhere. And ironically, although they activate neural circuits, they seem to control the rate of neurogenesis. Now that doesn't, and both glucocorticoids and especially NMDA receptors can regulate inflammatory and oxidative stress pathways. So a very possible mediator, which has not yet been investigated, would be to look at changes in telomere length. But as I said in relation to white blood cells, we don't know yet if that degree of telomere shortening is sufficient to impair the immune response, for example, to repair a wound or fight an infection. We do know that as people get older and their telomeres get shorter, in fact, they do have impaired immune function. So these things have yet to be done, but it's a very good question.
John.
Hi, I'm from Glasgow University. Thanks so much for a superb declamation of this area. Could you comment on the notion that pro-inflammatory cytokines in particular, but the immune system generally, has a titrating influence on new cell growth in the dentate particularly? And as a second point, whether you touched on this notion of early adverse events impacting negatively mm-hmm. in new cells, mm-hmm. but whether the serotonin system actually has a direct influence on that, and the genetic set of cards were dealt, as it were, is such that really we can't do anything about that. So
okay.
The impact of adversity is perhaps predestined in a way genetically to be adverse.
Well, okay, you may have to remind me. I'll try to answer the questions in order. The first one regarding inflammation. I mean, I think in general, inflammatory processes, when they're properly regulated, for example, IL-6, has actually neuroprotective effects and neuromodulatory effects. And these cytokines are present, produced in the brain, are present throughout the body, and as long as they're not out of control, dysregulated, they do a lot of important good things. Just like I said with these inverted U's for cortisol, every mediator seems to show that. If you overexpress IL-6 in the brain, you have all sorts of problems, inhibited neurogenesis, and there are a number of papers now showing that inflammation, elevated brain inflammation, is associated with reduced neurogenesis. Second question on serotonin. Serotonin, and you were referring, I think, also to the serotonin transporter alleles. When a person or an animal has that particular allele, the general effect is to impair serotonergic, well, it's actually impair the reuptake of serotonin. So on the face of it, it does the same thing as, say, Prozac. But this is something that's present during a person's whole life. And so the serotonin system is developing, and we know that serotonin is extraordinarily important early, even in embryonic life, in neural development, neural tube closure, a lot of things that are going on in the brain. And, of course, it's important in adult life. So having deficient serotonin function developmentally, we know, is increases vulnerability, as I said, to a number of disorders, alcoholism, substance abuse. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so the paradox, as I referred to, is that it works supposedly the same as Prozac, but that tells us that we don't really understand how antidepressants work. They work in some way that goes well beyond what the serotonin reuptake block is going. But it also raises the very important question about, you know, developmental deficits. There's also alleles of BDNF, which very much, again, insufficient BDNF leads to many of the same aspects as deficient serotonin function. And so we're just beginning to learn, and these are alleles that are present in the population. And so, as you sort of suggest, the fact if you have this allele, and based on the CASPI study, if you have certain adverse experiences, you may show some real problems that someone with the other allele wouldn't be as vulnerable to. And yet, if you hadn't these experiences at all, you may have quite a normal life. So that's the nature-nurture part of the story.
So psychiatrists don't actually understand what they're doing when they give antidepressants. I'm shocked, Jonathan, I'm shocked.
Well, go out and exercise if you can do it. Yeah. So.
Bruce, I've looked at this literature reasonably as carefully as you can, and it's quite early on in the sense a lot of it's been done in animals.
Yep.
And in terms of translating it to humans, the message, you know, I'm thinking, well, what are the key messages here for health policy studies, intervention studies, and I'd be interested in your perspective. But is it? Have I got this right? Is that yes, you can improve people's, we'll try and improve people's behaviour in terms of the physical activity, body well doesn't work often, and eating better, and that's very hard. Or do we need to improve the sense of control to improve that? Or can we improve physical activity and health to improve sense of control? And, you know, how does it work?
Well, I mean, I think we would all agree from our own personal experience that having a decent sense of control over our lives is very important. If we don't have it, we suffer. And if you look at people lower down on the SES ladder, you realize how prevalent that problem is. And if you have a chaotic home life, as I was suggesting, you're going to have even greater problems even establishing that. So you're starting.
What is that plastic? Can we change it really?
Well, and that's the challenging question. I mean, the thing I guess I would get across from what we've done is that these things, I think, are repairable, especially the earlier in life you can intervene. But even if they're not, I mean, I wonder about this low self-esteem. There are ways of getting people to improve their self-esteem. Does this have a physiologic effect? So I tend, being a neuroscientist and now being newly in love with the prefrontal cortex, I tend to think that the top-down influence is very important. It's not the only thing, but it's something we haven't really thought. Enough. Yeah, exactly.
Andrew.
Is there any evidence relating to potential effects of therapeutic use of steroids where you have chronic high steroid levels that suppress physiological cortisol response? And if so, had any insight on the complexity of the balance of the fact that steroids may be doing something, but they're actually being used to suppress an inflammatory, an exaggerated inflammatory response, which you tell us might be harmful? Or are steroids just a marker?
Well, I mean, I think that I have not examined the literature, but I know that use in a number of autoimmune disorders is associated with some, especially in children, with some fairly profound and lasting impairments in cognitive function, including also a smaller hippocampus. I don't think cause and effect have ever been sorted out, but there's suggestions. On the other hand, the use of steroids in modest quantities is still, I mean, things like asthma, and of course I've been interested in the fact that these inhalants, some of them, the synthetic glucocorticoids, hang around longer and under worse conditions can produce an Addisonian crisis when people come out from under them, and that can have adverse consequences in itself. I don't think there have been any really good systematic studies of this, and yet I think be cautious and very even more worried about the chronic use of synthetic steroids, especially ones that hang around for a long time, for exactly the reasons you were alluding to. On the other hand, the question you ask about the levels of cortisol that are produced, for example, even in melancholic depression, which are nowhere near the levels that you find in Cushing's disease. And they are part of this network of allostasis that I referred to. And now, at least some of the thinking in biological psychiatry, I'm thinking of a recent review article by Andy Miller in a trends journal, is that a pro-inflammatory state may underlie many, if not all, forms of depression. And of course, we know increasingly that inflammatory states are related to many of these so-called disorders of modern life. Elevated levels of glucocorticoids can coexist with a pro-inflammatory state if you simply impair the ability of the glucocorticoid receptor to shut it down, and so glucocorticoid resistance is a factor. So it's an intriguing idea because we know that inflammatory cytokines can precipitate profound depression. That depression is actually related to that, and in a sense, cortisol is kind of a mediator, but it may not be even the most informative one if you put together Jonathan Seckel's work on how the reactivation of cortisol in tissues of the body doesn't really tell you what's going on in the tissue if you're just measuring blood levels of cortisol. So there's lots of complexity that I think we unfortunately realize we have to do more studies.
Any last questions?
I just wanted to come back to what you said about social support towards the end of your talk. And just to clarify, what you're presenting was an association or causal relationship between social support and a number of these markers. And if it is causal, can you tell us a bit more about what sort of social support seems to be positive?
Okay, well, the studies that I referred to, the work that I think it's still associative, but it gets into the causal pathway, or work by Carol Riff and Bert Singer and colleagues on the Wisconsin longitudinal study, where people who graduated from high school in 1957, and they looked at people, it was retrospectively, of course, who had sort of adverse life event, and they were monitoring this during a number, since that 1957, but I'm not sure exactly when the study began. But they were also looking at the effects of having a good education, having a good partnership, good social relationships with family, especially spouse, on the development of a number of disorders and the aggregate, the allostatic load score. So they were beginning to get at cause and effect pathways, even though they were still looking at it in an associative way. I can't think of any direct intervention study, but obviously, you know, we think of the same things. I mean, as I understand, social support is defined both in terms of the interpersonal relationship, but also providing people information that they can use to deal with things. And I think both of these are part. For example, the Olds studies on putting a social worker into the home of a first-time pregnant woman, providing education and emotional support for what to happen when the baby is born, showing even with a relatively brief intervention that the child does better. This is something that has to be done on a much larger scale to really appreciate its real significance. That's more the kind of intervention study you were asking about.
Okay. Well, I think, as I've said, this has been a tour de force. There's been a huge amount in that that I know a lot. Looking at a lot of the people in the audience, I know that you're going to go away and get into this in a lot more detail. I think it's thrown us a lot of challenges. It's particularly exciting, I think, in Scotland, you know, given our size, given our the nearness that we all have to policy-making capacity and so on, for us to be thinking about how we turn this kind of research, how we translate it into policy. I think there's a lot here that tells us how we can make Scotland's health look better in the future, and Glasgow's health, reminding yourselves that this is a Glasgow Centre for Population Health lecture. Before we finish, just to remind you that there's a glass of wine available, the opportunity to discuss this a bit longer. It's in the Alexandra Room. Now, I know where the Alexandra Room is. Who else knows where it is? You go out this door here, over into the far corner, and go up the stairs. And as you go up the stairs, turn round and go back on yourself. It's at the front of the building. It's the large room at the front of the building. I'll try and get out there so I can lead you up. But being a good Glasgow audience, you'll be able to smell the wine. So one final thanks to Bruce for a terrific lecture, and a grateful thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule to come over to Scotland to see us.